When it comes to belief in God, that idea is put on trial in the modern world, and it's long been put on trial. And sometimes Scripture that we hold sacred is called to witness to in an attempt to try to discredit the idea of the existence of God or something about the Christian faith. And we're going to do the same thing with atheism and with the theory of evolution in our study this evening. We're going to do what Paul did at Athens. We're going to call up the opponent's witness to testify against them, so to speak. We'll do a little bit of that. We'll have Scripture. The Bible does say preach the word, and I still believe in that. We'll look at Scriptures that are relevant to some of the things that we talk about, but we'll also look at other quotations from representatives of the atheistic evolutionary point of view. So tonight, it's a straightforward examination of the idea of special creation, versus evolution. Let's talk about these things together. Ecclesiastes 3:11 says, He's made everything beautiful in His time. Also, He has put eternity in their hearts, except that no one can find out the work that God does from the beginning to the end. So in this passage, he tells us that when God created man, he put eternity in their hearts. Now, that word translated eternity, if you happen to use the King James, you'll see that puts it as he put the world in their hearts. It's a word that can have a variety of meanings, just like a lot of our words in the English language can carry a variety of ideas, but it often carries the notion of eternality or longevity or forever or things of that nature. At the end of the day, it's whatever we settle on in terms of the specific meaning of the term there, it's very evident that he's telling us God has put in our minds when he created us the notion that there's something bigger than ourselves, but we're not able to fully figure out the scope that he is as a part of that thing that we instinctively know is there. Let's put it this way. Every nation or tribe believes in a supreme being of some kind. As you dig through human history, it's very difficult to find exceptions to that. Man clearly has some instinct of there being something bigger than me. In fact, I think it's fair to say that the human psyche is wired to crave something bigger than me. There's got to be more in this life than just putting a grin on my face every day. There's got to be more to it. And people, even people outside of the Christian faith or outside of the idea of believing in a God of heaven that created us all, people sometimes exhibit that notion that I just need something, I need to belong to something that's bigger than me. And I believe that's what this passage is more or less telling us. Maybe that's an oversimplified way of saying it, but he's saying God has given us this sense and this need. We can't fully bring him into view and fathom all his works, but we know there's something else out there. Atheists admit that this is a powerful force in the human mind, the urge to believe in a creator, to put it in those terms. And atheists admit that this is an unchangeable part of human nature, that it's just within us to have that urge to want to think, okay? There's got to be something more than just this. And that seems to be what Ecclesiastes 3:11 tells us. So when we talk about creation versus evolution, we're looking at a full opposite of ideas. On the one hand, in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. Now, it's one thing to believe that there is a God out there somewhere that did all of this in a vague and unspecified sense. And it's something else to believe in the God of the Bible. So tonight, as we talk about creation, I'm going to talk about believing in the God of the Bible per se, all right, as he has revealed himself. Because it makes sense that if we've got a creator, that he wouldn't leave us groping in the dark, that in some way he would reveal to us who he is and how we might access him. On the other hand, you have the idea of evolution. And it's very important that we explain when we talk about evolution, we're not talking about microevolution or evolution within a species. We're talking about macroevolution, which is evolution from one species to the next. As the graphic on the board clearly demonstrates, microevolution is the understanding that you can, by careful outcrossing, selective breeding, etc., you can develop different kind of dogs with different physical characteristics, but at the end of the day, they're all still dogs. That's microevolution. Nobody denies that. It's readily available and obvious to see. It happens all around us. But that is not proof of macroevolution, where a single-cell organism became a more complicated organism that evolved into a more complicated, into a fish, into a land reptile, into a land mammal, and eventually evolved into humankind over a period of millions of years. A belief in something like that is a totally different set of ideas. And the existence or the prevalence of microevolution in nature does not prove macroevolution, if you follow what I'm saying. The fact that you can selectively breed dogs and get different kinds of dogs doesn't mean that one of these days your dog isn't going to give birth to a monkey instead of a puppy. That's the issue at hand. Now, so we're going to look first at the idea of cause and effect. To believe in evolution, atheistically, I've got to believe that you've got an effect, the ordered universe, that has no cause. It's purely an accident. I think it's really important that we boil these things down to their simplest ideas so we can look at it clearly and not let the issue become convoluted in highly technical language, but see it in its simplicity. To be an atheistic evolution, I have to believe that accidents can cause organized wonder. Okay? On creation side, we look at the universe, and of course, let that graphic kind of depict not just the general look of outer space, but all the planets, including the planet Earth, and all the complexity of life on Earth as we understand it. Creation says that is caused by God. Okay? Atheistic evolution says there is no cause. There was just once upon a time, there was a random explosion that exploded, and from that explosion did not come chaos, but order. Now, in a very simple term, do explosions cause order? Or do they cause chaos? I think we've all seen explosions. Perhaps some of us have seen explosions a little bit too close for comfort. But any explosion that we've all seen on the news or in person or whatever, we've never seen an explosion that caused order. They always cause chaos. That's pretty basic. Now, I might wrap it in all kinds of scientific, so-called technical jargon to try to make it sound more believable, but at the end of the day, if I'm going to believe in evolution and atheistic evolution, I've got to believe in a cause that is an explosion for the effect, the universe. That's in effect saying there's an effect without a cause. So, on the Darwinian side, Darwin is the one who's known to have popularized evolution, Charles Darwin. To believe in that, you've got to believe that disorganized matter can organize itself. This happens by means of a great explosion, and lifeless matter can bring itself to life. To believe in Darwinian evolution, you've got to believe that if you look at a pile of dirt long enough, eventually something's going to spring to life out of that. And that might take millions of years, but it'll happen. That's what you've got to believe in order to believe in that. To believe in creation, you've got to believe that God created and ordered all things as the supreme mastermind and the supreme power, and that God did so by His wisdom and power, and that God is the giver of all life, that He initiated life. Which is more reasonable? That's not hard to figure out when you boil it down to those simple ideas, thinking about cause and effect. It makes much more sense to look at this effect of an ordered creation and say, there's got to be an orderly cause, a thinking mind and a powerful entity that made this happen. And when you get to describing this powerful, thinking, ordered mind, then you've just come to the idea of God. Here's what one atheist had to say about the existence of the universe. He said, now three lines of evidence, the motion of the galaxy, the laws of thermodynamics, and the life story of the stars pointed to one conclusion. All indicated that the universe had a beginning. Now as we look at some of these quotes, I want you to observe, he's very careful to not use the word created. But that's what he just said. At some point it had to be created. because there was a moment when it wasn't there, and then there was a moment that it was there. And so he's labeled that the beginning. Let's look at this statement. Modern science denies an eternal existence to the universe. Now, I can remember back in the 60s and the 70s going to school, especially in the 70s, as you got into, you know, junior high and high school science, they talked about matter always existing. And they basically have said that can't be. So if there was a time that matter didn't exist, then how did it come into being? Well, just one day it just appeared out of nothing in this explosion, and boom, there was matter. So if you take zero and multiply it by zero enough times, you'll get something. That's really what that says. That's an effect with no cause. And you and I have done enough math, we know that's nonsense. You have to have some kind of a cause to create the effect. You've got to bring in some kind of number value to go from nothing, zero, to something, the universe. And so when these guys talk about the universe can't be eternal according to the laws of science, that it had to have a beginning, what they're saying is it had to have been created. But they're not going to use the word created, because that introduces the idea of a creator. So instead of believing in God, we're going to believe in zero and say somehow that nothing can hatch all of this something. So in the beginning, matter created itself. Or in the beginning, God created matter, that his existence is outside of matter, that he transcends the material world. Okay, which seems more reasonable? Can anything create itself? I know I'm not the only person that thinks that sounds absurd, and I'm going to tell you why. Because it sounds absurd. And the reason it sounds absurd is because it is. Matter is eternal and creative versus God is eternal and creative. Which one makes more sense versus which one sounds more absurd? Regarding this whole issue, Sir Arthur Keith years ago said evolution is unproved and unprovable. We believe it because the only alternative is special creation, and that is unthinkable. The first time I remembered hearing this quote, I was a high school student attending a meeting where Michael's dad was preaching, and Jerry talked often about evolution, and he brought this quote up, and I thought, wow, this guy is saying we cannot prove what we believe, and it cannot be proven. How are you going to prove you can get something from nothing? How are you going to prove that explosions create order and life? Go ahead and get the most expensive, well-equipped laboratory in the world and try to figure that out. He looked at it and said, we can't prove this. And he admitted the reason we believe it is because we don't want to believe there's a God. Now, why would somebody not want to believe in a God? Well, the God problem introduces a divine being that has rules that we have to follow. And that's where the problem comes in. You go back to Psalms 14. The fool has said in his heart, there is no God. They are all corrupt. That's why they say there's no God, because they want to do what they want to do instead of doing what God wants to do. So they looked at the question and they eliminated the possibility of God and said, we're going to believe anything but that. Contrary to that, in the theory or the belief of special creation, I will praise you, for I am fearfully and wonderfully made. Psalms 139:14 says, marvelous are your works, and that my soul knows very well. So the belief in creation says that God is the ultimate cause of all these things. It looks at humankind and says, we are too complex, we are too magnificent to be the result of an explosion. Tomorrow morning when you're getting ready, go stand in front of the mirror and say, good morning, beautiful. You're too amazing to just be an accident. Now, let's not get carried away with ourselves, but let's take what God is telling us about humankind. If we're going to believe this, that God is telling us, I made you in a way that's special and magnificent. And you can look at anybody and, you know, see them going about their business, and it's too magnificent to be an accident. Because accidents don't create this and this. Accidents create chaos and debris. Explosions create ruin. Okay? That is not hard to figure out. And you know, you don't have to have a high degree in science or anything else to figure that out. That's pretty common sense. So the idea of creation looks at the most devout atheist and says, there's too much order in your thinking for me to think that you are the result of an accident and an explosion. What's true of humanity is also true of the universe. The heavens declare the glory of God, and the firmament shows His handiwork. Psalms 19 and verse 1. So he says, okay, quit looking in the mirror and saying, hello, beautiful, you're too great to be an accident, and turn and look at the skies and say, hello, beautiful, you're too magnificent to be an accident. There's so much math going on out there. And you get outside of town on a dark night where the clouds have cleared out and you can see all the stars, and you know that's all moving in ordered motion and in magnificent harmony. It's a symphony of power and beauty. The thought that that's the result of an explosion is absurd. Creation offers the alternative that God is the ultimate cause of this beautiful and magnificent effect. So let's look to the issue of the order of life. We've talked about just the existence of the material world, the existence of the universe, that it couldn't have always existed according to evolutionists. It had to have a cause, and God is the most satisfying answer to that cause. What about the origin of life? Evolution says there was once what they call a primordial soup. That's just a slurry of pool or a slurry of chemicals, water, mud, minerals, whatever. And one day, you know, once upon a time, it gets struck by lightning or whatever, and somehow that spontaneously generates a single cell organism. That's life coming from dead matter. Now think about that for a second. Is it reasonable to think that just a pool of slime can somehow magically come alive? But then it gets even more complicated. From there it goes to more complex life forms by means of random mutation, that these mutations within the genes, that it just keeps changing and changing and changing until life gets more and more complicated, and through millions of years of evolution it becomes human life. And when you boil that down to its simplest form, it sounds absurd. But you know what? You would expect us to have that opinion. You'd expect me to come to town and tell you that. Let's dig a little deeper into this spontaneous generation idea. I don't know. I assume most of y'all might have studied about that in science in junior high or high school. I remember when they talked about that. They talked about the French scientist who pulled out the, you know, the meat, and he set it out, and after a few days, boom, there was maggots and then flies. So he's like, well, maybe this is spontaneous generation. And he figured out later that flies were laying their eggs, and that's how that was happening. And when he put it in enclosure, he couldn't get it to come to life because dead things don't do that outside of divine input. And so he basically, trying to prove spontaneous generation, disproved it. And that's still a problem for science today. Robert Jastrow said, according to this story, every tree, every blade of grass, every creature in the sea and the land evolved out of one parent strand of molecular matter drifting lazily in a warm pool. What concrete evidence supports that remarkable theory of the origin of life? There is none. So you and I look at that as Christians and we say, that's crazy. This guy, as a proponent of that theory, looks at that and says, actually, we don't have any evidence for this. Now, when I showed you the quote earlier by Sir Arthur Keith, you might say, well, he went off the rails and said something off the cuff when he said it's unproven and unprovable. They probably have proven it since then. Well, this guy didn't think so. This guy thinks we still can't prove that life came from lifeless matter, a key component of the evolutionary theory. Franklin Harrell said, of all unsolved mysteries remaining in science, the most consequential may be the origin of life, a stubborn problem with no solution in sight. It's a real problem when you take God out of the equation. You keep multiplying zero by zero, hoping you'll come up with something, and all you get is zero. Because you've taken out the only energy that can give it an informed cause, an intelligent cause to give it design and make it come to life. And you remove that, and then you scratch your head that you can't figure out how to make it work. If it's not spontaneous generation that caused life, then what is the answer? I did not see this coming, but I first ran into this probably 10 or 15 years ago in a film about creation that I was watching where they were interviewing an atheist. And he's talking about, well, spontaneous generation has been disproven. It doesn't work. There's no evidence for it. What are you going to do? And he says, well, we think life was seeded by space aliens. And we're the ones with fairy tale, y'all. Okay. This is how determined some people are to not believe in God. Now, it does not take a degree from Harvard to see all this does is relocate the problem to the other planet. Because where that space alien come that came and sowed the seeds of life on Earth, how did life start on his planet? Sooner or later, you run out of planets and space aliens, and guess where you wind up? There's a God in heaven. It's the only reasonable alternative. Now, what this is a confession from these guys that we know it couldn't have happened this way. There had to be an intelligent cause. But instead of accepting that this intelligent cause has divine moral standards, we instead want to embrace an intelligent cause that flies around the universe in a flying saucer looking like this fella. Anything but God. Anything but I don't get to do what, you know, I want to do. Every other option is on the table. But a God that imposes divine standards on humanity, that's out of the question because we don't want the divine standards. The complexity of the simplest known type of cell is so great that it is impossible to accept that such an object could have been thrown together suddenly by some kind of freakish, vastly improbable event. Such an occurrence would be indistinguishable from a miracle. Now let that soak in. What he's saying is to believe that there was this slurry, this pool of liquid and mixture of chemicals, and that somehow spontaneously formed a single cell organism. He's saying believing in that would be barely indistinguishable from a miracle. It sounds like an act of God, doesn't it? That's what miracles are, right? In the sense that he's talking about, miracles are an act of God. So these guys are dancing all around, not using the word creation, not using the word created, not saying God. They're finding other language to use instead that points to the same concept, but without all the moral trappings of divine demands. Now, going back to our diagram, we've talked about spontaneous generation and the impossibility of that. Let's look at this idea of random mutation. That's the idea that when that single cell formed, it's genetic material that basically is the blueprint that tells it how to grow and what to grow into, to oversimplify it, that genetic material kept changing and changing and changing and mutating over time, which those mutations can happen, until that thing become a multi-cell animal, until it started swimming and started crawling and, you know, crawled out on the land and started breathing. And then before long, you had these different kinds of mammals until millions of years later, one of those mammals was kind of like a monkey. And then as time kept marching on, these mutations kept happening until humanity evolved along with all other life forms and plant life and all of that. Came from this one single cell that just kept mutating. So let's talk about these random mutations. The law of biogenesis states that life produces after its own kind. Now, let's put that in simple terms. That means when you get two dogs together, what they have is puppies. They don't have kittens. Now, any kid in this audience knows that. But to put it in heavier terminology, though, that's the law of biogenesis. To believe in evolution, I've got to reject that. I've got to say, if you get two dogs together often enough, eventually you're going to start having kittens. There's no world in which that's reasonable. Wheat does not grow corn. Monkeys don't birth humans. It's simple. You can try to dress that up and disguise it behind a wall of millions of years of gradual, you know, mutations, but at the end of the day, you've still got this problem. And because of the problems with the idea of mutation, some have even said, well, maybe they just happened all at once. They call it, I love how they put fancy names on this, they called it punctuated equilibrium. Let me tell you what punctuated equilibrium means. It means we know the idea of gradual mutations don't work, so we really do believe that one animal gave birth to another kind of animal. That evolution happened in these huge leaps, and they come up with that theory to try to solve a lot of problems with the evolutionary theory, and sounded more ridiculous because anything but God is on the table. I would rather believe that dogs give birth to kittens than to believe that there's a God who has demands and expectations of me. For an organism to change, genetic material must change, and these changes are known as mutations, okay? Evolution demands there be abundant, beneficial mutations so that the fish keeps having mutations till it grows legs and grows lungs. And these mutations have to happen simultaneous with other mutations in codependent systems or mutually dependent systems, and they also have to happen simultaneous with mutations in other organisms where there's interdependence back and forth. It gets really complicated, so much so that the probability is ridiculously low. Evolutionists admit that mutations are errors, and 99% are harmful, not beneficial. So let's put it in this word. There can't be enough beneficial mutations to make a fish grow legs to become a land mammal. It can't happen. But we're going to believe it. Here's what George Gaylord Simpson said. Most mutations with large effects are lethal at an early stage for the individual in which they occur and hence have zero probability of spreading. He said it can't work. And this is a guy that believes in that theory. And he's going to set up camp and say, I insist on believing in this theory that, oh, by the way, I know can't work. I heard not too long ago that they say blue eyes in humans are a result of an early mutation. I think quite a few of you folks are blue-eyed. That's a rare example of a mutation that it's not harmful. Just changes the color of your eyes. If you're married, your spouse may think it's pretty beneficial. Maybe they like that your eyes are blue. I don't know. But that's supposedly all humans used to be brown-eyed, and finally a mutation come along and boom, they're blue eyes. Now let me ask you a question. Does that mean you're any less of a human? Well, of course not. You're still a person, you just look different. Microevolution. You see what I mean? There can't be enough of them that's big enough to change you from one species to another. Here's what Warren Weaver said. Many will be puzzled about the statement that practically all known mutant genes are harmful, for mutations are a necessary part of the process of evolution. How can a good effect, evolution to higher forms of life, result from mutations, practically all of which are harmful? That's a fair question. The guy's saying, how can our system work? Because these things are harmful. Well, the standard answer is give it enough time. You string together enough failures, you'll finally have a winning season. When I read statements like this, I don't know how this strikes your mind. But I walk away from this refreshed and thinking, you know, we're not as dumb as they tell us we are. And I hope you'll remember that. Here's creation's answer to the origin of life. that God created us to reproduce after our kind. Genesis 1, 24 through 25. God said, let the earth bring forth the living creature according to its kind, cattle and creeping things, beasts of the earth, each according to its kind, and it was so. And God made the beasts of the earth according to its kind, cattle according to its kind, and everything that creeps on the earth according to its kind. And God saw that it was good. So here's what creationists believed, uninformed as we supposedly are, that if I plant corn, it's going to grow corn. That if I plant okra, it's going to grow okra. And if I breed dogs, I'm going to get puppies. Is that really that uninformed? Do you really have to be stupid and backwards to believe that? You tell me who's backwards. You tell me who believes in the fairy tale. That I can somehow plant corn and grow wheat. That I can somehow breed dogs and have kittens. Now come on, this is not complicated. Now, I'm putting it in these terms and kind of badgering the point, I freely admit. Please bear with that. But I'm doing that for a purpose. I want you to have confidence that the only reasonable conclusion is there's a God in heaven. That's the only reasonable conclusion. This that we've been force-fed as reason is not reason at all. So let's talk about the fossil record. Well, fossils prove evolution. That's what I was taught in science class in school. Here's what David Ropp had to say. A large number of well-trained scientists outside of evolutionary biology have unfortunately gotten the idea that the fossil record is far more Darwinian than it is. Let me translate that for you. Everybody thinks the fossil record proves evolution, but it doesn't. That's what he's saying. All right, let's keep reading. Also, there's probably some wishful thinking involved. In the years after Darwin, his advocates hoped to find predictable progressions. In general, these have not been found, yet the optimist has died hard, and some pure fantasy has crept into the textbooks. Let me translate that for you. After Darwin cooked up his theory of evolution, everybody took their shovels and ran to the field and thought, we're going to find all these missing links from these different forms of life and different organisms, all the way from the single cell up to the complicated, you know, mammal life, bird life, and so forth. And we didn't find it. But we believe it anyway. Because, you know, optimism dies hard. And he even admits that a lot of what's in our textbooks is pure fantasy. I remember seeing pictures of that pure fantasy. And they presented it as though, yeah, we've proven that this is, looks more like a cow, this looks more like an elephant, and this looks more like a rhinoceros. And they built this complicated tree. Not out of what they dug up in the soil, but out of human imagination. I still think, to the unprejudiced, the fossil record of plants is in favor of special creation. So we get it outside of mammal evolution or birds or fish or reptiles or whatever, and look at plant evolution. He says if you go to looking at the plants, it really favors the idea of special creation, of believing in the Bible. What does the Bible say that explains different human races or nations of people? Acts 17, 25 through 26 says, nor is he worshipped with men's hands as though he needed anything, since he gives to all life, breath, and all things. And he has made from one blood every nation of men to dwell on all the face of the earth, and has determined their preappointed times and the boundaries of their dwellings. The biblical story of creation says we got life and we became what we are because God made us that way. And he made us so genetically diverse that every different nationality of people on the earth all came from the same set of parents. You know, science admitted that a few years back when we all have one common mother. No, duh. Her name was Eve. Well, let's not go that far, because that might introduce us to the God who has rules. Think about that. Now, on this idea of the different nationalities of people coming from one common origin, that's something we're going to talk about more in the course of this meeting. But for tonight, we're just going to leave it there. So let's look at this idea of human evolution. We've all seen the diagrams. It's easy to draw this stuff. You start out as a chimpanzee, and then you get more human-like until you get down to the end. I don't know how many times I've seen some kind of picture like that represented in a textbook. So let's go to the fossil record. Obviously, we're not going to talk about every supposed example of the different links along this chain of humanoid life, so we'll just look at a few examples. And I want to start out with one that was used in the Scopes trial. That was the trial that was held in the United States to try to defend the right of teaching evolution in school as a fact of science. And one of the pieces of evidence that they introduced in the Scopes trial was this Nebraska man. You see him there? Well, that's obviously kind of part ape and part human, right? And there's his wife over there, and there they are in that primitive world. It's got apparently some camels in the background. I mean, you can see it, right? Where'd they get this idea? From this tooth, okay? Some of you have probably heard about this Nebraska man. So from that tooth, they drew that picture and said, believe it, this is science. Just shh, go back to sleep, trust the science. We'll take care of this, okay? This was in 1922, a tooth was discovered. Henry Fairfield Osborne said it combined the characteristics of a chimpanzee and a man. So he looked at this tooth and said, this has to be an intermediate form between a monkey or an ape and a human. Okay. In June 24th, 1922, the Illustrated London News had a drawing. There it is. They can't lie in the newspapers, right? That's what they put in there. The tooth was actually the tooth of a wild pig. It had nothing to do with apes or with humans. But you remember those statements we read earlier where he said pure fantasy has found its way and the fossil record is not as, you know, evolutionary as we would think? Here's some of the reasons why that's the case. Encyclopedia Britannica admitted at a later time that the tooth belonged to a being of another order. Don't you love that? Instead of just spitting it out and saying, it's actually a pig's tooth and we were all a bunch of idiots that didn't know what we were doing. Well, it's a being of another order. You sound a little more sophisticated when you put it that way. Now, really, am I supposed to have full confidence in a field of study that looks at that and concludes that and wants me to believe it without question? Now, I know that's long since been dismissed. But let's not forget what the Scriptures tell us in Romans 1, 21 and 22. Because although he knew God, that they did not glorify him as God, nor were thankful, but became futile in their thoughts, and their foolish hearts were darkened, professing themselves to be wise, they became fools. And I think Nebraska man is an example of that. Somebody didn't want to believe in God. They wanted to put God out of their mind, and you know, it was all because of sin when you read the context of Romans 1. And so it is today. And so in an effort to prove something besides God and professing themselves to be wise, they became as fools. But, like I said, that's long since been dismissed. Don't worry about that. We've learned better since then. And so later on, they discovered Piltdown Man. Here's what's interesting to me about Piltdown Man. I remember reading about him in the science books in the 70s in junior high and high school. 1970s. I remember seeing pictures. I remember, you know, the different publications. I had a friend that was big into some of that stuff, and he showed me, look, Piltdown Man. And they just had a way of talking about it that just captured your imagination. It just sounded so believable. Now, the darker parts of that picture is the actual fragments they found. The rest of that is fill in the blank, okay? Well, they can't just make that stuff up, right? They're scientists. So they put this all together, and they went from piecing together these fragments into this imaginary skull and said, he probably looks something like this. And so, Dave, you need to put your Bible back on the shelf and believe what we're telling you when we tell you you evolved from monkeys, and this guy was in between that monkey and you. Okay. This was discovered in 1912 and 1913. This was widely accepted and widely celebrated as an intermediate form, the missing link. And it was exposed as a forgery in 1953. And 20 years later, it was still in my science book. Why? Could it be that these guys know the fossil record doesn't favor their view, so they're just going to leave in there what they think they can get by with? I wonder if they'd do that. That piece right there, that's a human skull. This right down here is a primate jawbone. That means he's some kind of a monkey. That tooth right there is a dog's tooth. These parts were filed or treated biochemically to look older than they really were. It was a deliberate fraud. Now, if after Darwin we all run out and stuck our shovels in the ground and it's obvious that this evolutionary theory is true and all we got to do is start digging and we'll find the intermediate forms, why did they have to make stuff up? You know, you've got the issue of dishonesty, but this doesn't mean every evolutionist is dishonest. That's not fair to conclude that. It does demonstrate that the scientific community was bamboozled for 40 years by some pretty simple things. It didn't take much to fool them. Could it be that they have a bias that's predisposed to want to believe these things rather than to fairly examine the evidence? Oh, stay tuned. We're not done with that. John 8:44 tells you where these lies come from. You're of your father, the devil, and the desires of your father you want to do. He was a murderer from the beginning and does not stand in the truth because there's no truth in him. When he speaks a lie, he speaks from his own resources, for he is a liar and the father of it. So it's very clear this is deliberately dishonest, and so not all of them are that dishonest, though. So let's be fair and let's talk about Lucy. Lucy is still presented as a supposed missing link, an intermediate form. There's a couple of depictions of her. There's what they actually found of this one that they have named Lucy. She was discovered in 1974. Surely by then they'd figured things out. It was widely accepted and celebrated, and is still widely accepted and celebrated. But this anthropologist come along and said, Lucy's fossil remains match up remarkably well with the bones of a pygmy chimp. So you had evolutionary science saying, guys, this is a missing link, part monkey, part man, to put it in oversimplified terms. And this lady looked at the bones and says, no, it's not. It's just a chimpanzee. There's nothing evolutionary about it. Here's the guy that discovered Lucy. There is no such thing as a total lack of bias. I have it. Everybody has it. The fossil hunter in the field has it. If you are working back at around 3 million, as I was, this is very seductive. Because you begin to get an idea that that is where Homo did start, meaning human ancestors. You begin straining your eyes to find Homo traits in fossils of that age. Logical? Maybe. But also biased. I was trying to jam evidence of dates into a pattern that would support conclusions about fossils which, on closer inspection, the fossils themselves would not sustain. I interpreted it based on my presupposed belief in evolution. That's what he just said. It is hard for me now to admit how tangled in that thicket I was, but the insidious thing about bias is that it does make one deaf to the cries of other evidence. Let me interpret that for you. There were people trying to tell him, dude, this is just a chimpanzee. Oh, no, it's an intermediate form. And they showed him the evidence. Oh, no, it can't be. This is a missing link. And now he's telling you, I wouldn't listen to him because I was so stuck on saying I'd found something. And he finally concluded, Lucy has been dethroned. She's not the missing link that we said she was. Now, he made this statement in 1996. This was published in National Geographic, but Lucy is still talked about today as a human ancestor. I saw a documentary just the other day, a fairly new documentary that talked about Lucy as though she was an accepted missing link form of life. She even appeared again in the 2010 issue of National Geographic as a missing link. When years earlier, the guy that discovered her said, yeah, it's not that we messed up. Remember that the next time you pick up a National Geographic. Well, they got all this evidence. Remember that. That's what they've got right there. O Timothy, guard what is committed to your trust. Avoid the profane and idle babblings and contradictions of what is falsely called knowledge. We now know. No, they don't. How many times have I read in a textbook that was pushed in front of me, well, we now know. No, they didn't. And some of them knew better than at the time. They were just lying to try to prop up a theory they knew they couldn't prove. God's answer to the matter is, God bless them, and God said to them, be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth and subdue it, and have dominion over the fish of the sea and over the birds of the air and over every living thing that moves on the earth. God said, I made humans as humans, and they have human babies. That's pretty observable, isn't it? In the greater question, I'm made to remember 1 Corinthians 1, verse 23 through 25. We preach Christ crucified, to the Jews a stumbling block, and to the Greeks foolishness. But to those who are called, both Jews and Greeks, Christ the power of God and the wisdom of God, because the foolishness of God is wiser than men, and the weakness of God is stronger than men. We've looked at just a small sampling of examples. I know there's a lot more out there that could be discussed, but this is enough for the study of the hour. That shows man's best attempt to outsmart God looks pretty foolish. Now, we believe in the cross, don't we? We believe in creation. I know there are people that think that's laughable. I mean, this week I'm offering you some of the evidence that are reasons why I don't think it's laughable, why I think it's actually proven. I believe in Jesus. I believe in that more now than I ever have. I believe in the resurrection. I believe in creation more than I ever have for a lot of the reasons we're talking about this week. I know it's foolish to some people, but I also know that a lot of these folks have already admitted they look at the evidence with a jaundiced eye. They look with a predetermined bias that they don't want to believe in that. And so their insistence that it isn't true doesn't shake my faith, especially when I look at their own theory and see the silliness therein and see what the Scriptures tell us, that the foolishness of God is wiser than men. I hope you can see that too in our study this evening. And I hope that in this truth you find a sense of peace, that you're not just a pointless accident. I want to drive that thought home. You're not just a pointless accident. You're not just the debris left from an explosion, but you are the act of God's design, and you matter to Him. And He loves you and He wants to save you from things we've all done to bring about our own ruin. And as we continue to study these things together this week, I hope you'll grow in your faith in that. And if you need the church to help you tonight in that growth process, we'd love to help you. If you're a Christian, you need the prayers of the church, we'd be glad to assist you. If you're not a Christian, you want to become a Christian, we'd be glad to help you. If you need further study, there are brothers and sisters here that'd be glad to take time and study with you. If we can help you in any way, please come. Have a seat on the front while we stand and while we sing.